Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Tuesday, November 22nd. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Got some house cleaning to do and changes that are going to transpire today. I thought that we were going to be able to speak to WMU Cooley law professor Brendan Beery and fellow law professor Jeff Swartz, but they're not going to be available. They're both sick, and they need the rest. And so we hope that they'll be able to resurrect their good health by the time Thanksgiving is around, and wish them the best, them and their families. And we'll miss them today. And but we'll talk about the Constitution, to the U.S. Constitution today, hopefully in about a week's time, and when they're feeling better. And we wish everybody who's going to be celebrating Thanksgiving, and we hope everybody can and does, the best of holidays. So we're going to get immediately immersed into the, I guess, what's going on in the world stage. So let me quickly look at it, because I guess one of the things that's most interesting is that Gazprom, that's Russia's company, is accusing Ukraine of diverting gas supplies, and it's threatening cuts, no less. Seems that Russian energy giant Gazprom today threatened to cut provisions of natural gas after accusing Ukraine of diverting supplies intended for Moldova. Earlier on Tuesday, Ukrainian security services raided an 11th century Orthodox Christian monastery in Kyiv in a counterintelligence operation against suspected, quote, subversive activities by Russian special services, end quote, according to an official statement. Well, Ukraine's in the afternoon, Ukraine's gas transmission system operator denied an assertion by Russian gas company Gazprom on Tuesday that Ukraine had withheld 52.52 million cubic meters of gas meant for Moldova, and accused Russia of using gas as a political tool. Quote, "This is a gross manipulation of facts in order to justify the decision to further limit the volume of gas supplies to European countries," it said in a statement. Well, Russian energy Gazprom said on Tuesday that Ukraine was diverting natural gas supplies transiting to Moldova and threatened to curtail deliveries through a key pipeline to Europe in response. Well, the volume of gas supplied by Gazprom for transit to Moldova via Ukraine is more than a physical volume transmitted Moldova, Gazprom said in a statement. So the St. Petersburg-based company said that Ukraine had allegedly obstructed 52.52 cubic million cubic meters from being delivered to Moldova and threatened cuts in response. Quote, "If the transit imbalance through Ukraine for Moldovan consumers persists on November 28th, from 10 o'clock on, Gazprom will begin reducing gas supplies through a key transit point for deliveries to Europe," the company said. Well, on top of that, it seems that authorities are encouraging residents to leave Ukraine this winter as the country faces shortages of essentials exacerbated by the lack of infrastructure due to Russian attacks. And there are particular concerns for hospitals, with most now being outfitted with generators. That's what they said from Ukraine. Quote, "There are questions as to fuel, water, and other basic supplies, particularly medical supplies." Ukraine's security service carried out a raid on a historic Orthodox monastery in the capital of Kyiv over suspected, quote, activities, end quote, of Russian agents, according to an official statement. And located south of Kyiv's city center, the 11th century Kyiv Pershelsk Lavra is a UNESCO World Heritage Site and seat of a branch of Ukraine's Orthodox Church that was formerly under Moscow's jurisdiction. It cut ties with Russia soon after President Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine. The SBU Security Service said in a statement that counterintelligence measures, quote unquote, were carried out as part of work to, quote, counter the subversive activities of the Russian security services in Ukraine, end quote. The statement said that Kyiv aimed to prevent the use of the site as a center of the Russian world and make sure that the premises were not used to hide, quote, sabotage and intelligence groups, end quote, and to store weapons. Well, it seems that Russian shelling hit a humanitarian aid distribution center in the town of Orikhiv in southeastern Ukraine, killing a volunteer and wounding two women, according to the regional governor. Oleksandr Starukh, a governor of the Zaporizhia region, gave no further details of the attack on Orikhiv, about 110 kilometers, that's about 70 miles, east of the site of the Zaporizhia nuclear power station, which has been shelled in the past few days. Well, Kyiv is going to investigate purported Russian prisoners of war video. It seems the Kremlin has accused Ukrainian soldiers of executing more than 10 Russian prisoners of war after a video circulated on social media sites. Footage appears to show a group of Russian soldiers surrendering with their hands over their heads, and one of the men appears to fire at the Ukrainian soldiers before gunfire is heard and the bodies of around 12 men can be seen. Well, the location and identities of the people in the clip have not been verified. Reporting from Kovlev in southern Ukraine has already promised an investigation into the incident. Quote, there may be more to the video than it seems. The Ukrainian Human Rights Commissioner said that this was, in fact, a staged surrender, where a gunman appears towards the end of the video and opens fire. If that turned out to be Russian fire, that would be a war crime, the crime of perfidy. You have to note the differences in the way that Kyiv looks into allegations like this and Moscow does. Kyiv promises investigations and says it will get to the bottom of things. With Moscow, you see outright denials and even turning the situation around to blame Kyiv or to blame Ukraine. Well, the vulnerability of Russia's Black Sea port of Novorossiysk comes under scrutiny in the latest United Kingdom military intelligence briefing. It seems that on November 18th, multiple Russian and Ukrainian media outlets reported that an attack took place at an oil terminal in Novorossiysk port, a major base of Russia's Black Sea Fleet. Well, the Black Sea Fleet relocated many of its submarine operations in Novorossiysk after its Sevastopol base in occupied Crimea was struck by Ukraine over the summer, notes the United Kingdom briefing. It seems that Russian commanders will likely be concerned about threats to the Novorossiysk-based amphibious landing ship flotilla, said the United Kingdom's military intelligence in a Twitter post. Well, any demonstration of a Ukrainian capability to threaten Novorossiysk would highly likely represent a further strategic challenge to the Black Sea Fleet. Well, and there are other things too. Ukrainians are most likely to live with blackouts at least until the end of March, according to the head of a major energy provider. Half of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has been damaged by Russia's attack. President Volodymyr Zelensky said, leaving millions of people without electricity and water as winter sets in and temperatures drop below freezing. Sergei Kovalenko, the head of Yasno, YASNO, a private energy provider for Kyiv, said that workers are rushing to complete repairs before the winter cold arrives. Quote, I would like everyone to understand Ukrainians will most likely live without blackouts until at least the end of March, Kovalenko said in a post on his Facebook page. Well, residents are urged to evacuate Kherson, Mykolaiv. Seems the Ukrainian authorities have urged residents of the southern regions of Kherson and Mykolaiv, which Russian forces have been shelling for months, to move to safer areas in the central and western parts of the country. Ukrainian Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk has said that the government will provide transportation, accommodations, and medical care for them. So we'll have to see what happens. Bear with me a moment. This is really important. More than 10 million Ukrainians are without electricity, says Zelensky. Million Ukrainians were without electricity on Thursday, said Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, as Russian missiles pounded energy facilities in yet another barrage targeting civilian infrastructure across the country. The scale of torture that has been discovered in the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson, taken back from Russian troops this month, is horrific, a Ukrainian ombudsman said on Thursday. This was last week, and since the Russian army retreated last week, following 8 months of occupation, chilling accounts have started to emerge of abuse, mistreatment, and torture in Kherson. Lubyanets said that the authorities had found, quote, torture chambers, quote, unquote, where he said dozens of people had been tortured. He said that Ukrainians were electrocuted and beaten with metal pipes. United Nations Nuclear Watchdogs Board of Governors passed a resolution on Thursday expressing, quote, grave concern that Russia had not heeded calls to cease actions against nuclear facilities in war-torn Ukraine. So it goes on and on and on. Australia's foreign minister on Friday urged Russia to surrender three men found guilty of shooting down Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 and called out President Vladimir Putin for, quote, harboring murderers, end quote. A Dutch court on Thursday of last week sent three men to life imprisonment over the 2014 downing of the Malaysia Airlines flight over Ukraine. Russians Igor Girkin and Sergei Dubinsky and Ukrainian Leonid Kachenko were found guilty in absentia of shooting down the Boeing 777 with a Russian-supplied missile, killing all 298 passengers on board. Foreign Minister Penny Wong had said that the verdict confirmed the, quote, Russian Federation has responsibility, end quote. Fresh Russian strikes hit cities across Ukraine last Thursday, the latest in a wave of attacks that have crippled the country's energy infrastructure as winter sets in and temperatures drop. So it goes on and on and on. It's unrelenting. And Zelensky said more than 10 million Ukrainians are without electricity and therefore without water as well. Unbelievable. And Kherson is the most heavily mined part of Ukraine. Frightening. It just doesn't end. This atrocity that keeps on continuing. It's just unbelievable what is going on. Anyway, let's look at some other things which are a little bit in soccer. Messi says that the World Cup defeat to Saudi Arabia is a, quote, very heavy blow. Well, Lionel Messi said that Argentina's shock loss to Saudi Arabia was a very heavy blow, quote, unquote, but vowed the South American champions would bounce back from the defeat. Quote, it's a very heavy blow, a defeat that hurts, but we must continue to have confidence in ourselves, Messi said after Argentina crashed to a stunning 2-1 loss in Group C. Quote, this group is not going to give up. We will try to beat Mexico, he added. Messi gave Argentina a 10th-minute lead from the penalty spot on Tuesday at the Lusail Stadium, but second-half goals from Saleh Al-Shahri and Salem Al-Dalsari helped the Saudis pull off one of the greatest shocks in World Cup history. It could have been so different, but for three tight outside calls in the first half that went against Argentina, denying them three potential goals. In the second half, coach Lionel Scaloni's men failed to exploit the Saudis' high defense line in the way they had managed before the break. Quote, "We know that Saudi Arabia is a team with good players who move the ball around well and play a high line," said Messi. Quote, "We worked on that, but we rushed it a bit. There are no excuses. We're going to be more united than ever before." Quote, "This group is strong and has shown it before. We had not been in this situation for a long time. Now we must show that this is a true group." The Albi Celeste, who have two Group C games remaining against Mexico on Saturday and then Poland the following Wednesday to try to salvage their hopes of claiming a third world title. Playing in his fifth and probably final World Cup, Messi has the weight of an entire nation's expectations on his shoulders. One of the greatest players of all time, this may be his last chance to lift football's greatest prize, which his predecessor as Argentina's idol Diego Maradona did in 1986. I mean, I'm practically in tears reading it. Quote, "We have to go back to the basics of who we are. We have to think about what's coming next," said the seven-time Ballon d'Or winner. Unbelievable. What an unbelievable game. It's absolutely mind-boggling, to be honest with you. One second. Now let's just quickly look and see some other things. This is really interesting as well. Charles III, the King of Great Britain, hosts a first state visit as King, aiming to bolster South Africa ties. Seems that King Charles III hosts the South African President Cyril Ramaphosa from Tuesday for his first state visit since ascending the throne following the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II. The three-day trip will be aimed at, quote, "celebrating cooperation between South Africa and its former colonial power." Now, although South Africa is the United Kingdom's biggest trading partner in the African continent, it is, quote, "one which it has too often taken for granted," end quote, writes Christopher Van Dom, a senior research fellow with Chatham House's Africa program. It is therefore quite significant that King Charles III's first state visit will be to welcome South African President Cyril Ramaphosa and his wife, Dr. Tshepo Motsepe, from Tuesday to Thursday. I mean, from today to Thursday. Well, the British High Commissioner to South Africa, Anthony Phillipson, has heralded this visit, quote, saying, "This will be the very state visit hosted by His Majesty. It reflects the importance of the relationship between South Africa and the United Kingdom. The visit will offer a chance to celebrate our modern-day partnership delivering prosperity and security for both countries, as well as to set out how we can work together bilaterally and globally to strengthen those links for the future." Well, South Africa held symbolic importance for Queen Elizabeth II. She delivered a speech there pledging her life to the Commonwealth's service as a 21-year-old princess. Charles III himself visited South Africa on numerous occasions and attended Nelson Mandela's funeral in 2013. Only time will tell what kind of relationship this new monarch, who has already met with several African leaders, including Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari and Ghana's Nana Akufo-Addo, will have with the continent following the first state visit. Inviting Ramaphosa on a state visit is part of the United Kingdom's post-Brexit Global Britain initiative. And this was implemented by former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, quote, to resolidify its Commonwealth foreign policy, as Britain's ambitions are to have closer, more profitable relations with members of the Commonwealth, said Douglas Yates, a political scientist specializing in African politics who teaches at the American Graduate School in Paris. Well, Queen Elizabeth II had organized this visit which was postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And because of the, quote, difficult position that she found herself in regarding the Commonwealth, explains Mario Aguiar, a professor of religion and politics at the University of St. Andrews, who has expertise in South African politics. At least six Caribbean countries, Belize, the Bahamas, Jamaica, Grenada, Antigua and Barbuda, and St. Kitts and Nevis, expressed a desire earlier this year to become republics and remove the Queen as their head of state. Commonwealth in 1961 to later rejoin in 1994. According to Aguiar, the late Queen's aim with this visit was to encourage South Africa to remain part of the Association of Nations. The country has played a central role in the African Union since Mandela was in office and exert a considerable amount of influence on other African nations. As Aguilar explains, quote, where South Africa goes, other countries like Nigeria, Kenya, and so on follow suit. Yates said that Queen Elizabeth II had hoped to maintain good relations with South Africa because as head of the Commonwealth, she saw each member as important and she may have been concerned about the potential for the war in Ukraine to alienate Johannesburg, she said. Further, it was added that Britain's Conservative Party, led by former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, was supporting Ukraine while South Africa wasn't. Commonwealth gives Britain a chance to maintain good relations with countries that aren't supporting Ukraine. This visit will mark Charles III's first as head of the Commonwealth, a position he lobbied for extensively during the last decade of his mother's reign, as he feels the crown can maintain real foreign policy interests through this role, says Yates. Following the Queen's death, there has been growing concern that the association has run its course, and so King Charles will certainly be using this visit to, quote, consolidate his position as head of the Commonwealth, he added. Although Aguilar acknowledges that, quote, it is possible that the Commonwealth will face challenges under King Charles III, at the moment there is no indication that it might end as a structure of cooperation. Yates had agreed that, quote, people are afraid as Queen Elizabeth II has been the only head of the Commonwealth and times have changed. But at the same time, King Charles III has been preparing for this job his whole adult life, and the Commonwealth has actually been growing and even attracting countries that aren't former British colonies, such as Togo and Gabon. Ramaphosa will also be seeking to consolidate his position back home. The South African leader, who replaced Jacob Zuma as president on the promise of clean government, is now facing accusations of corruption. He is hoping this visit will legitimize his position and that of his party, the ANC, the African National Congress, ahead of its leadership role in December and South Africa's general election in 2024. According to Yates, South African Democratic Party, the opposition has become steadily more popular with each election as it uses issues such as high inflation and poor energy infrastructure to question the ANC's effectiveness, thus becoming more popular and presenting itself as a viable alternative, end quote. Ramaphosa will get his wish, delivering a 20-minute speech about his vision of the world to both the House of Lords and Commons on Tuesday, that's today in the afternoon, in the Royal Gallery of the House of Lords. And this is a rare honor, as most state visits don't include this, Aguilar explained. This is a vote of confidence in Ramaphosa, one that wasn't even extended to French President Macron, for instance, despite the close relationship between France and the United Kingdom. Yates and Aguilar both agree that this visit will be about celebrating, quote-unquote, cooperation, and that although the new king may bring up the issue of the war in Ukraine, there is nothing to suggest that the visit will be uncomfortable or about lecturing Ramaphosa on his stance. Yates says this is a smart approach to adopt as the United Kingdom is never going to get South Africa to position itself just with the West, because it is playing a double game of aligning itself with both Russia and the West. Russia is a longtime ally of the ANC, supporting it during its fight against apartheid in South Africa. There has also been a, quote, a lot of anti-Western rhetoric coming out of South Africa recently, as the country feels the West is behaving in an imperialistic way by expecting African nations to toe the line regarding the war in Ukraine. South Africa, like the 16 other African countries, recently abstained from voting on the United Nations resolution condemning the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Furthermore, Ramaphosa refused to condemn Russia's invasion. South Africa is part of the BRICS, the BRICS group, composed of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, countries that are seen as the world's leading emerging market economies. While Russia's February 24 invasion resulted in widespread condemnation from G7 countries and their allies, the only BRICS country to support the United Nations resolution was Brazil, with South Africa, China, and India abstaining. The United Kingdom will also be keen to bolster ties with a major trading partner at the time of economic turmoil. As of November 18 of 2022, total trade in goods and services between the United Kingdom and South Africa amounted to 10.7 billion pounds. That's an increase of 6.3% from 2021. Further developing those ties will be high on the agenda when Ramaphosa visits Prime Minister Rishi Sunak on Wednesday. That's tomorrow. Britain's new prime minister will hope to renew the trade agreement with between the two countries to include lower tariffs to help with the United Kingdom's financial crisis. South Africa is already the United Kingdom's biggest trading partner on the continent, and we have ambitious plans to turbocharge infrastructure investment and economic growth together, Sunak said ahead of the visit. Quote, I look forward to welcoming President Ramaphosa to London this week to discuss how we can deepen the partnership between our two great nations and capitalize on shared opportunities from trade and tourism and security and defense. Unbelievable. Fascinating stuff, that's to say the least. One second here. Now let's look at what's going on with Iran. Iran has started enriching uranium to 60% purity at its nuclear site, media report. Iran has started enriching uranium to 60% purity as its underground Fordow nuclear site, according to state media on Tuesday, which described the action as a response to the United Nations nuclear watchdog's demand for more cooperation from Tehran. Well, Iran is already enriching uranium to up to 60% purity elsewhere, well below the roughly 90% needed for weapons-grade material, but above the 20% it produced before a 2015 agreement with major powers to cap enrichment at 3.67%. Well, in a letter to the International Atomic Energy Commission, or agency IAEA, Iran has conformed the agency that it has started enriching uranium to 60% purity as Fordow site, at the Fordow site using IR-6 advanced centrifuges, the semi-official ISNA news agency reported. The IAEA's 35-nation Board of Governors on Thursday passed a resolution ordering Iran to cooperate urgently with the agency's investigation into uranium traces found at three undeclared sites, diplomats at the closed door vote said. Well, the semi-official FARS, FARS news agency said that Tehran had also started the process of replacing the first-generation centrifuges, IR-1, with advanced IR-6 ones at Fordow, a site buried inside a mountain. The 2015 nuclear pact between Iran and six world powers lets Iran use only first-generation IR-1 centrifuges, but as the deal unraveled after then-President Donald Trump ditched it in 2018. Tehran installed cascades of more efficient advanced centrifuges such as the IR-2M, IR-4, and IR-6. In June, Reuters reported that Tehran was escalating its uranium enrichment further by preparing to use IR-6 centrifuges, which can easily switch between enrichment levels at the Fordow site. Iran's SNN television network said that Tehran had begun installing new cascades or clusters of advanced centrifuges at its Natanz and Fordow nuclear sites, adding that doing so was a strong response to the IAEA's latest resolution. Iran has started the process of injecting gas into two cascades of IR-2M and IR-4 advanced centrifuges at the underground Natanz site, SNN reported. Well, the IAEA resolution is the second this year targeting Iran over the investigations, which has become an obstacle to talks on reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal because Iran has demanded that the probe be ended. Iran's foreign ministry on Monday dismissed the resolution as politically motivated, quote-unquote. Indirect talks between Tehran and the United States President Joe Biden's administration to revive the 2015 accord have been at a stalemate since September, with both sides demanding more flexibility. Iran's crackdown on anti-government protests sparked by Mahsa Amini's death in custody and the sale of drones to Russia have turned the United States' focus away from reviving a nuclear deal, and U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said on Monday. Iran denies selling drones to Russia for use in the Ukraine war. Well, point is they're doing what they want, and that was to be expected, even though the world said it wouldn't come about. Unbelievable. Now, this is very interesting. Turkish drone are hitting Syrian Kurdish base that was used by the U.S.-led coalition, say the Kurds. Seems a base in northeastern Syria, used jointly by Kurdish forces and the United States-led coalition, was hit in a Turkish drone strike on Tuesday. According to a Syrian Kurdish group and independent monitoring agency, the strike came as the United States and Russia urged Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to call off a planned ground invasion into northern Syria. A joint base north of Hasakeh, used for planning and executing joint operations against the Islamic State group, has been hit by a Turkish drone, a spokesman for the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, Fahad Sami, advised, adding that two SDF fighters had been killed. A British-based monitoring group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, confirmed the joint base had come under attack, but was not immediately in a position to say whether coalition forces had been present at the time. Turkey launched a series of airstrikes under Operation Claw Sword on Sunday, hitting dozens of Kurdish militant targets across Iraq and Syria. And Tuesday's strike in Hasakeh came hours before Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his country would soon launch a ground operation in Syria against Kurdish militants. We have been on top of terrorists for a few days with our planes, cannons, and drones, Erdogan said in a televised address on Tuesday. Quote, God willing, we will root out all of them soon with our tanks, artillery, and soldiers, end quote. Erdogan's address came despite U.S. and Russia warning against a ground offensive in Syria. Russia on Tuesday called for Turkey to exercise restraint, quote, unquote, and warned against, quote, destabilizing, end quote, Syria. We understand and respect Turkey's concerns regarding its own security. We believe this is the legal right of Turkey, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters. We will call on all parties to refrain from steps that could lead to seriously destabilizing the situation, he said. He added that it would, quote, boomerang, or could boomerang, back and further complicate the security situation. The U.S. on Monday also called for a de-escalation. We urge de-escalation in Syria to protect civilian life, common goal of defeating ISIS, U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said in a statement referring to the fight against the jihadist Islamic State group or itself. Well, Turkey's latest escalation of its ground, long-standing conflict against Kurdish militants follows a November 13 attack in Istanbul that killed 6 people and wounded 81. Ankara blamed the attack on the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which is blacklisted as a terror group by the United States and the European Union. The PKK was involved in peace talks with the Turkish state before Erdogan scrapped negotiations in 2016, has denied involvement in the November 13 Istanbul attack. Erdogan has threatened a new military operation into northern Syria since May and upped those threats in the wake of this month's bomb attack. Turkey has launched 3 offensives into Turkey, or rather into Syria, since 2016, aimed at crushing Syrian Kurdish fighters whom it charged are allied to the PKK. Erdogan has repeatedly called for a 19-mile safe zone to protect southern Turkey against cross-border attacks from Syrian territory. At least 3 people, including a child, were killed in a Turkish border town on Monday by a rocket strike fired from Syria. Well, this is going to implode, that's for sure. This is not going to be able to be held back. It's frightening. God. All right, we'll just have to see how that's going to happen. 1 second. This is very interesting. The Uyghur influencers are peddling Beijing's propaganda narrative. While part of the international community denounces the repression of the Uyghur ethnic group in Xinjiang, a region in western China, Uyghur influencers, quote unquote, offer an idyllic vision of their daily life. But a growing number of human rights organizations and the United Nations have documented China's severe repression of this Muslim ethnic minority. Australian researchers have analyzed more than 1,700 YouTube videos featuring young Uyghurs, Kazakhs, Tibetan, and Mongolian women, all of whom are ethnic minorities, victim of Beijing's policy of cultural unification. The influencers play the role of model citizens, and some even openly deny accusations of genocide and forced labor in China. In the episode of The Observers, we find that how their team established clear links between the women in these videos and the Chinese Communist Party. So this is absolutely amazing. So it's just like make-believe. It's truly amazing, you know, what people will do. Literally amazing. Okay. Now let's quickly cover this as well. Dozens have been killed in a factory fire in central China. Suspects are taken into custody, evidently. It seems that 36 people were killed and 2 were missing after a fire at a plant in central China, state media said on Tuesday, citing local authorities. Fire broke out at a plant in Anyang City in Henan province on Monday afternoon. News agency Xinhua reported without sharing further details. State media said that rescue services first received reports of a fire at the afternoon locally. And after receiving the alarm, the principal fire rescue detachments immediately dispatched forces to the scene. China closed cable TV reported, and public security emergency response, municipal administration, and power supply units rushed to the scene at the same time to carry out emergency handling and rescue work, it said, adding the fire was extinguished by around 11 o'clock local time in the evening. Well, footage from the scene shared by state media showed thick plumes of black smoke from the fire with at least two trucks in position to battle the flames. In addition to the dead and missing, two were sent to hospital with injuries that were not life-threatening. Authorities said that criminal suspects had been taken into custody in connection with the fire, but did not provide further details. No reason has been given for the cause of the blaze. Industrial accidents are common in China due to weak safety standards and corruption among officials tasked with enforcing them. Well, news of the Anyang City fire followed reports of an explosion at a chemical factory in nearby Taiyuan, the capital of Shanxi province, on Monday. Well, video posts on social media showed a fire at the industrial site spewing dense gray smoke into the sky. Other images showed nearby buildings strewn with shards of glass and frightened locals fleeing the blast. Personnel were dispatched to the scene. The fire was extinguished, and the human toll is not yet known. Dehabao, an official daily based out of neighboring Henan, reported on the Twitter-like Weibo platform, citing authorities. In June, one person was killed and another injured in an explosion at the chemical plant in Shanghai. The fire at Sinopec, Shanghai Petrochemical Company plant in the outlying Jinshan district, sent thick clouds of smoke over the vast industrial zone as three fires blazed in separate locations, turning the sky black. And last year, a gas blast killed 25 people and reduced several buildings to rubble in the central city of Xi'an. In March of 2019, an explosion at a chemical plant in Yancheng, located about 151 miles from Shanghai, killed 78 people and devastated homes in a several kilometer radius. 4 years prior, a giant explosion in northern Tianjin at a chemical warehouse killed 165 people, one of China's worst ever industrial incidents. Unbelievable stuff that goes on. Well, let's look at what's happening in South America. The Colombian government is resuming formal peace talks with the ELN rebel group. It seems that Colombia's government and the National Liberation Army, the ELN, the last recognized rebel group in the country, on Monday, resumed formal peace talks in Venezuela for the first time since they were suspended in 2019. Talks are a push by President Gustavo Petro, who in August became Colombia's first ever leftist leader and has vowed a less bellicose approach to ending violence wrought by armed groups, including leftist guerrillas and drug traffickers. In their first meeting, parties agreed to, quote, resume the dialogue process with full political and ethical will, according to a joint statement. They added that the talks' aim is to, quote, build peace, end quote, and make, quote, tangible, urgent, and necessary, end quote, changes, highlighting the need for, quote, permanent compromises, end quote. First round of talks will last 20 days. The ELN started as a leftist ideological movement in 1964 before turning to crime, focusing on kidnapping, extortion, attacks, and drug trafficking in Colombia and neighboring Venezuela. It has around 2,500 members, about 700 more than it did when negotiations were last broken off. The group is primarily active in the Pacific region and along the 1,370-mile border with Venezuela. Dialogue with the group started in 2016 under ex-president Juan Manuel Santos, who signed a peace treaty with the larger Marxist Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC, a rebel group that subsequently abandoned its weapons and created a political party. But the talks with the ELN were called off in 2019 by conservative former president Iván Duque, following a car bomb attack on a police academy in Bogotá that left 22 people dead. Petro, himself a former guerrilla, reached out to the ELN shortly after coming to power as part of his, quote, total peace, end quote, policy. The ELN peace talks delegation spent 4 years based in Cuba, as they had been barred from returning to Colombia by the previous government. They traveled to Venezuela last month, where the first round of talks were announced. Colombian Peace Commissioner Ivan Danilo Rueda hailed a historic moment for the country after the meeting. ELN delegate Pablo Beltran said he hoped that dialogue would be, quote, an instrument of change, and we hope we won't fail, end quote. In Colombia, we all have to change and overcome the dynamic of death, he said. Caracas is hosting the first meeting, and the talks will rotate between the other guarantor, Cuba, and Norway. A statement from the guarantor nation said on Monday the meeting was an important step to achieve peace. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro processed as a message of hope for a peaceful Latin America and Caribbean at a rally in the capital. Colombia has suffered more than half a century of armed conflict between the state and various groups of left-wing guerrillas, right-wing paramilitaries, and drug traffickers. So it goes. So it goes. Unbelievable. Okay. Bear with me a second. One moment here. All right, let me just check this because this is the latest soccer game. Denmark has drawn a 0-0 with Tunisia at the World Cup. In Denmark opened the World Cup campaign with a 0-0 draw against Tunisia in Group D today. Christian Eriksen started his first match at a major tournament since his harrowing on the field collapse at the European Championship last year, but was unable to provide the spark his side needed. Let's just quickly look at this. Bear with me a moment. I'll be able to play this for you. This comes from the World Cup at France Verkats. 1 second. All right, bear with me a moment here. Okay, we could play this.
So, Lenny, you've also been watching the Denmark-Tunisia match. That's wrapping up, I think. Tell us about that and then give us a flavor of the mood there ahead of the France-Australia match.
That's right. It's a bit of a surprise, really, that this ended as a goalless draw. The Tunisians are putting out a really solid showing against the Danes. The Danes are who were billed as one of the dark horses coming into this competition. But it was really Tunisia that showed more creativity and imagination. They started the far more lively side. They were roared on by a sea of Tunisian fans who celebrated every challenge and clearance as if they had, well, scored. Their best opportunity came just on the stroke of half-time with Issam Djibali raced onto a ball and forced a excellent one-handed save by the keeper, Kasper Schmeichel, for Denmark. The second half was just as lively start as the first one for the Tunisians. And so there was the Danes who probably came closest in the second half with a shot by their star midfielder, Christian Eriksen, which forced another good save, this time by the Tunisian goalkeeper. goalkeeper who flicked and pushed the ball up over the crossbar. So this is really a big result for the Tunisians here this season. They are trying, they're bidding to get out of the group stages in the World Cup for the first time in their history. And of course, this game this evening also has implications for the reigning World Cup champions, France, as they kick off their campaign this evening to retain their World Cup title against the Australians, as they did back in 2018. Les Bleus have really had a setback after setback before even kicking a ball in this competition. Obviously, the latest blow being Karim Benzema, who is out injured. He is just the latest name on a long list of injuries for the French squad. Paul Pogba, N'Golo Kanté, Presnel Kimpembe, and Christopher Nkunku. Though Didier Deschamps has made it very clear that he has a lot of confidence in this group of players, with a lot of young generation players who are making their debut at the World Cup now having to step up. It would be a real shock this evening if Les Bleus didn't manage to get a win against Australia, who are featuring in their consecutive fifth World Cup.
Okay, thanks very much, Selena. We'll leave it there. Good luck tonight.
All right. Okay, so that's the story there. And I think I'll just check to see if there's anything else we could share with you. Bear with me a moment. One second here. This is very interesting because this might end up coming about here in the United States, but this is a report about what's happening in Pakistan, and I know a lot of people think it won't happen here, but it is happening here. Newspapers are fighting for survival as sales plunge. Print journalism subscriptions and readership have been plummeting as people increasingly get their information from digital sources, which is what we've been doing. Mujahid Hussain, a news hawker in Islamabad, says he is afraid of losing his job amid a downturn in newspaper sales in Pakistan, where people are increasingly getting their information from digital and social media platforms. My employer often talks about a slump in newspaper sales and a possible business shutdown. So even if he doesn't close shop, my job is definitely on the line, the 42-year-old father of three said. Well, Hussein pointed out that he has already experienced massive pay cuts over the last 3 years and that his family is struggling to make ends meet. Many other vendors, news vendors in the South Asian country share similar woes. It was not always like this, however. Even until a decade ago, the newspaper industry thrived in the country. Daily newspapers, weeklies, and magazines used to be used to be a must in offices, living rooms, and cafes. But print publications were first eclipsed by the dozens of private TV news channels that were launched during the presidency of General Pervez Musharraf between 2001 and 2008. Then came affordable smartphones, social media networks, and widespread internet connectivity, which further dented newspaper sales as more and more people began to consume news on online platforms. Downturn in the newspaper industry has particularly affected hawkers, who mostly work part-time for meager wages. These low-paid workers are taking on another informal job or to make ends meet. Successive governments haven't taken interest in the welfare of newspaper hawkers, so they are generally disheartened, insecure, and always on the lookout for better options to make money, said Akil Abbasi, the general secretary of the Newspaper Hawkers Union. He explained that before Musharraf's government liberalized the broadcast media and telecom sector, Rawalpindi, the capital, had around 1,600 newspaper vendors and Islamabad 700. But with the plunge in sales, the number of vendors has dropped to 900 as opposed to 1,600 in Rawalpindi, and the 700 in Islamabad have been reduced down to 480 respectively. He said, stressing that the COVID-19 pandemic and ongoing economic crisis had accelerated the trends. Another problem compounding the woes of newspapers is that their reliance on government advertising for economic survival outlets are critical of government and military policies have had a tough time generating enough advertising revenue in recent days. Will they survive? News hawker Hussein warned that if the fall in sales did not stop, the print media would have no other option but to get rid of most of its workforce. And some senior journalists share a similar view. Salim Bukhari, who once edited the leading English language newspaper, The News and The Nation, currently heads the digital media team at the City News Broadcast Network. He said that, quote, no one wanted to spend time reading through newspaper columns given the ocean of information available on mobile phones. He said that newspapers might disappear if the trend continued, although he did not believe that this would happen that soon. Will the electronic media era will ultimately make newspapers doom? The advertisers have diverted their money to TV channels, and even the government prefers electronic media for advertisements, he pointed out. Hassan Gilani, a media development professional, was more pessimistic. He said that newspaper readership might have declined after the emergence and development of electronic media, but it's unfair to suggest that print media could soon become a thing of the past, he said. Though digital media has jeopardized the business of small newspapers, big and credible newspapers will survive as people trust their opinion and editorial judgments and will need them for an in-depth and insightful analysis of issues, he added. Well, stressing that editorial staff were the backbone of the newspaper industry, Gilani had urged publications to ensure their economic well-being and demanded that the government protect their rights and interests. Some still prefer print over digital. But despite pungent sales, some readers say they still prefer print media over other TV and social networks. I grew up reading printed newspapers and editions and still begin my day scanning the newspaper at breakfast. And if the newspaper isn't published or delivered, I grab an old copy to accompany me to the breakfast table, said Musa Han, a retired bureaucrat in his early 70s. He notes that he also uses electronic and social media channels to follow national and global development. But he said that reading on a table or mobile did not give him the same satisfaction as reading a printed newspaper. That's the end of our time slot with you today. And we wish our friends over at Brendan Beery and Jeff Swartz a happy Thanksgiving, and to them and their families, and that they get better soon because they're under the weather. And we hope they'll be back and at it next week. Let's hope. And we wish everybody good health and a happy Thanksgiving. But we'll be on with you tomorrow. Let me see. I'm trying to think now. What was special about tomorrow? I forgot what it was. On such a high level of medication that I'm sometimes forgetting. But I remember that I forgotten. Question is trying to remember what it is that I need to know. What I'd forgotten. Let me see, there was something special about tomorrow. Oh, yes, I forgot. No, I mean, how stupid can I be? Well, tonight is going to be the vote that's being taken by the Yonkers City Council to either grant mayor of the city of Yonkers, Mayor Mike Spano, an additional 4-year term. and in an election process, but just to give him that opportunity, which we understand he's interested in running for another four-year term. This would make it his fourth four-year term. So a total of 16 years in office if he should win. So we're going to be speaking with the mayor tomorrow at 10 o'clock. So hopefully you'll consider joining us. We'll see what the outcome is, but he's scheduled for tomorrow at 10. So that's the story with us. Thanks for your indulgence. Thanks for your patience as well. And we'll go on from there. So not only will we cover this story, but we'll be doing some other things as well. Anyway, so that's the end of our time with you today. We'll say goodbye. And we go back to the studio screen here. Bear with me a second. So we'll end this episode and we'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.